Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, everyone. I realize I've done a few episodes now without actually saying my name. So my name's Elle, and I will be your host for this episode of What's the Crack? This episode, I sit down with Danielle Smith from Roswell Park in Buffalo, US, and talk about tobacco, e-cigarettes, and a little bit about cannabis. We discuss the different ways of using cannabis and the international differences. We discuss e-cigarettes in youth, flavors in tobacco and e-cigarettes. We discuss the gateway theory of whether using e-cigarettes is a gateway to tobacco use, and we talk about why people use e-cigarettes. We touch on a lot of topics, and I hope you enjoy a whistle-stop tour of tobacco, e-cigarettes, and cannabis. Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of What's the Crack? I'm here in Buffalo at Roswell Park, and I'm joined with Danielle Smith. Danielle, could you give me a sentence or two about what you do and who you are?
Hi everybody, my name is Danielle Smith. I'm a master's level senior research specialist here at the Department of Health Behavior at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, and I work on e-cigarette research in the division.
Awesome. Very succinct and lovely. Okay, so I have been looking at your work, and it's quite broad. For example, I've seen stuff that you've done on e-cigarettes, on tobacco, and then tobacco and marijuana. So I'd like, first of all, let's go on your PhD, because you're doing a PhD student. Can you tell me what work you're doing on your PhD?
So my focus, so I'm a PhD student actually at State University of New York at Buffalo Division of Community Health and Health Behavior. So I'm in my second year over there. Mm-hmm. And the work that I do over there is looking at modes of delivery of tobacco and marijuana with a specialized focus on smoked and vaporized cannabis pocket of people that are using both drugs. So what is the impact of using both of those drugs on addiction reinforcement and then on respiratory health?
Okay, that's interesting. So is it, from what I remember with reading, is like some people will use cannabis and then either with the addiction purposes, like think that they're addicted to cannabis when in fact it's the tobacco that goes in them. Is that a kind of thing with the modes of use that you're looking at?
A little bit. So I guess one thing that's interesting to note about modes of delivery is that there's a lot of heterogeneity that goes on, and a lot of that is geographically specific. So I guess what I thought of when, you know, when you brought up your last point, is like rolling a spliff, right? A spliff is, you know, you put tobacco and you put marijuana in the same, you know, product, like a joint. That's certainly one thing that's like included in part of my research portfolio, but I'm interested in even the people that don't do that. That's a very like UK phenomenon, European phenomenon, you know, more overseas. In the US, you don't get so much of that kind of co-administered behavior, at least in that sense. I'm interested in the folks that, you know, they use cannabis, they use a nicotine product, and they just happen to be dual users of the product. And how do those dual use behaviors kind of reinforce their, you know, nicotine dependent, you know, their dependence on one or both substances?
Great. So is how far into your PhD are you?
So I'm in my second year. I'm really just looking at really wonderful data set that we have access to. We as a research community anyways, it's called the Population Assessment of Tobacco and Health. It's the largest publicly funded study of tobacco in the United States. I'm using that data set to look at quantity frequency interactions in cigarette and e-cigarette use and how that is predictive of substance use behaviors.
Could you tell us a bit more about the PATH study? That's the acronym, right?
Yeah, the PATH study. It's a machine. I don't even know where to start. It's so large. So the PATH study is a longitudinal cohort study. So what that means is, you know, there's a giant team at this data collection agency called Westat, and they survey and by doing that, they can look at all sorts of really interesting relationships in, you know, tobacco use behaviors over many, many years. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that the particular relevance and some of the novelty of the PATH study is that you can look at non-cigarette tobacco products. So we have this emerging, especially everywhere, but really in the U.S. too, you know, you have cigarettes, and we know cigarettes are harmful. They're the most harmful nicotine delivery product. And, you know, tobacco control community's done a pretty good job of, you know, diminishing the prevalence of smoked cigarettes. But in the meantime, what's been happening is all of these other products have kind of been popping up, and, you know, there's not much that's known from a scientific angle about those. So e-cigarettes are really probably the most well, like, spoken about, probably the most well popularized of those products. So, you know, a study like PATH will really get us a better understanding of, like, how those products are used by people, what implications that have for addiction, and what impacts those have on user health long term.
Great. That sounds so interesting. And I like the acronym because it means like a path, a journey.
Right.
A journey of someone. what was I going to say? Oh, yeah. Within the non-tobacco nicotine products,
sure.
Is that also including things like IQOS? 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 I don't know how it's said.
IQOS is
the
way
IQOS.
So IQOS, yeah. IQOS is qualified. It's a little different than an e-cigarette. Mm. They call it a heat not burn tobacco product. So what those products do, it's got similar features to an e-cigarette,
mm-hmm.
But a little different in that there's actually tobacco, like a tobacco stick that is inserted into the device and then heats the tobacco just under the point of combustion. So there's essentially like a vaporization that happens and people inhale this vapor that contains nicotine. So
yeah.
Not quite an e-cigarette. E-cigarettes are different because they have a solution that contains nicotine. The solution usually is some base of propylene glycol, which is found in fog machines, and vegetable glycerin. So it's one or the other, it's usually some mixture of both, and then that contains nicotine flavorants, all sorts of other things. So similar sorts of ideas conceptually, but in terms of the delivery and how it gets there and what that could mean for user health, it's pretty different.
Yeah, and it's another product that I see that is, you know, air quote, looking to be healthier or less harmful than a tobacco product.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's been some studies on toxicant emissions and things like that. Actually, one of our lab techs from our group did a presentation on the IQOS device at the SRNT conference that you and I just attended. And, you know, that's obviously not definitive in terms of what it could expose users to long term and what that means for user health. So is it really safer? Well, the only thing that will tell is time, right?
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
A lot of these diseases that are a product of tobacco use, they have really long latency periods. They take a very long time to develop. So, you know, in the case of IQOS, in the case of e-cigarettes, you're not really going to know if it's like safer compared to a cigarette until, you know, 10, 15, 20 years down the line.
Absolutely.
You're looking at people in studies like, you know, PATH or other longitudinal cohort studies where you can see if folks that use those products develop these illnesses.
Yeah, absolutely. And small anecdote, I went for research. I went to buy an IQOS in their shop in London.
Oh, cool.
And I think they were trying to give, I guess, an impression that they were fancy and quite upmarket.
Mm-hmm.
So I just went to buy one because we were sending it over to Canada to test.
Oh, cool.
And so I had the money, I was ready to go buy, and it was such a scene from Pretty Woman. I was dressed like a student, I walked in, there were so many shop assistants and, you know, just maybe two other people shopping around, all ignored me. And everyone else was dressed smart and they were all just like helping these other people that was there. And I don't know whether it was just me or because I was dressed like a student, but I was like, I literally have money to buy this. I literally have money, why won't you let me?
So did they sell it to you?
I ended up selling it to me, but after they'd addressed everyone else in the room and when I was at the cash point ready to pay.
Oh, boy. Well, it's good you didn't have to like go back in like Julia Roberts did.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And then flash your money around and
dress fancy and go,
it was,
see?
It was a wonderful scene.
But yes, that's my big memory of IQOS. But what else was I going to ask?
So I've done a small bit of work on e-cigarettes, mm-hmm. and we've looked at four countries, so the US, the UK, Australia and Canada. And prevalence-wise, the US and UK are higher, generally because of the rules, because Canada and Australia don't allow nicotine-containing e-cigarettes to be sold.
Yeah.
But what is the prevalence for US? Do you know?
So in adults in the United States, a recent estimate from CDC is about 3% of adult current e-cigarette users. So that's kind of an interesting definition. We know that from our other work, most e-cigarette users are current or former tobacco users. The vast majority of people that have never picked up a cigarette don't use e-cigarettes. At least that's what the data show right now. When you're looking at youth, prevalence is a bit higher. So e-cigarettes are pretty popular amongst teens. The popularity of e-cigarettes in youth actually exceed those of tobacco cigarettes.
Okay. Now, I was looking. Yes, I was looking at slight uses when I was doing it. But my question is, I guess, is that, do we know whether that's in replacement to starting tobacco? As in, is this? So if youth are picking up e-cigarettes, are they doing that when they would have picked up tobacco cigarettes? Or is this, I've tried tobacco, it tastes like crap. E-cigarettes taste nice. Is it a case of, I was going to do something anyway? I guess there's a lot of avenues to go down with that, but I can't see whether it's like, I can't decide whether it's a good, not a good thing. These are words that I don't want to say, but you know, like the whole less harmful thing with air quotes of, would it be better that they're taking e-cigarettes? Because if they were going to do tobacco anyway, is that better? But then it's a case of, but we don't want them to do anything at all. So then is it a bad thing?
Right. And, you know, it's interesting you say that because this is an issue that I have thought about. So the short answer to that question is I don't think there's a very good science base to give a data-driven answer to that question. We do know that, you know, teens are experimental. So teens, you know, drug use is very obviously prevalent in adolescent years because teens, you know, tend to just experiment during that time frame. Whether or not e-cigarettes are something that's used as a function of, you know, I tried a tobacco cigarette and it tastes like crap, or hey, there's this cool novel device and all of my friends are using it. You know, I think we still need more data to kind of support good answers to those questions. So I guess I'll shamelessly self-promote for a moment. I'm actually just about to submit a paper. And so I'm leading this paper that's looking at prevalence of exclusive and dual cigarette and e-cigarette use among a sample of youth in Poland. So this is a serial cross-sectional study. And what we're finding is in the survey years 2010 to 2011, you had really high prevalence of cigarette use, very small prevalence of e-cigarette use, very small prevalence of dual use. And then what happens is over the next two survey periods, the e-cigarette use rates increased a lot. Right. And what happened as a function of that is the dual use rates increased a lot and the cigarette rates decreased.
Okay.
So, you know, we don't have the data to support in that particular study, like, are e-cigarettes a gateway drug? This is something that people love to talk about.
Yes.
You know, our design wouldn't speak to that because we're not tracking the same people over time in those behaviors. But it would certainly suggest that e-cigarettes are shaking up the product mix for teens. So, you know, they're new, they're cool. You know, I use that term air quotes. So there's something novel about them. And I would say that might have something to do with it. But that's, you know, that's just kind of my read of my one data source.
No, it's interesting. I also love the gateway theory because people love that. And I feel like it's taken the shine off cannabis being the gateway drug.
Right.
Like, how about e-cigarettes now? And it's like, oh.
So. Yeah. Gateway theory, I have, gateway theory is interesting. I think it's, the thing with gateway theory is that I think it does put too much emphasis on the product. We know that from, you know, epidemiology has its wonderful, like, breadth of tools, you know, but we know from, like, more of the psychological realm that there are individual level predictors that are associated with substance use behavior. So then you get into theories like common liabilities to addictions, and, you know, there are pockets of people that just have increased or decreased propensities to, like, pick up substances in general. So when we're looking at gateway theory, are we really looking at that? Many epidemiologic studies don't control for those sorts of, you know, predictors. So I think that's something that maybe you and I can do that.
Yeah.
Let me go out into the world and then we'll figure out all of the real answers
yeah.
to these questions.
Exactly. It's funny because I was just having breakfast before I came here and the people at the coffee shop were discussing the fact that caffeine's a drug. And then someone who was buying the coffee said, well, I'd rather be on this drug than any other drugs. And then someone else said, oh, well, you know, it may be a gateway to other drugs. And then the guy behind, who was the cafe owner, said, that's stupid. Gateway theory is ridiculous. It also said, after that, it said, everyone knows alcohol's the gateway drug. And I was like, oh, hello. All right, that's interesting.
That's all very interesting. It's interesting that you would hear that in a public coffee shop.
Exactly,
it makes me kind
of
happy to hear that it was in a public coffee shop, because maybe the message isn't completely lost on the public. You just see so much of gateway theory, and maybe that's, you know.
What else was I going to ask? E-cigarettes. I was going to ask, because I saw you did a paper on, or you were involved in a paper on flavoured tobacco and quit behaviour.
Yeah.
Is that correct? Could you talk a bit about that? Because I have a question following.
Sure. So that paper, we looked at a large survey of adults in the United States. So this was a population 18 years and older, and it was a population-based nationally representative study. We asked them lots of questions about lots of different tobacco products. I think there were 9 or 10 total. So cigarettes, e-cigarettes, various types of cigars. There's 3 major types: traditional cigars, filtered cigars, cigarillos, snus, smokeless tobacco, dissolvable tobacco, pipes. I'm sure I'm missing something. Was that 10? I'm not sure. So we asked them all of these questions, and then we asked them, you know, was your first use of these products, provided they were using the products, was your first use of this product flavored, and are you currently using a flavored product? So long and short is that my sample size wasn't sufficient to look at, like, each product in specific detail, so we kind of aggregated this look of flavor, or this look at flavors over this, like, distribution of products. So this included menthol cigarettes and included what they call characterizing flavors in tobacco products. So, you know, Beetlejuice flavored e-cigarettes. That's one of my personal favorites. Or Bahama Mama, you know, or Cherry Skull or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so these types of products. So what we found is that if people reported using a flavor at their first use, they were significantly more likely, by like several orders of magnitude, to report current use of flavored tobacco products. And when we restricted our analyses to folks that were only using non-cigarette tobacco products with a flavor, they had reported reduced odds of quitting tobacco altogether.
Okay. That's interesting. So in the US, is there... Because in the UK, we've basically just got tobacco and then menthol.
Sure.
Do you have any other flavors in the US for tobacco?
For a cigarette?
Yes.
So cigarettes, it's just tobacco cigarettes and it's menthol cigarettes. Right. So you could get them there. I mean, there were certainly people in our sample that they could have reported using, you know, a cherry-flavored cigarette when they first used. But at the time of the survey, that wouldn't have been available.
Okay. I will always get slightly confused with the fact of, like, we know that flavors in tobacco is, you know, reduces our likelihood to quit. However, flavors in e-cigarettes are still available. So it's just, is that good because it takes people away from tobacco, or is that bad because it gets people on it and you're probably less likely to quit the e-cigarettes?
That is the million-dollar question, I think, for so many researchers. And, you know, I do think, just as somebody that's worked with these data and kind of seen a lot of papers on the topic, you know, the fact that there are flavorants present in e-cigarette products is a concern when we look at things like youth initiation. I mean, kids, I want to say one of the more recent Monitoring the Future surveys, nearly 2/3 of youth reported not using nicotine in their e-cigarettes, but so many of them, I mean, the vast majority reported using flavors.
Oh.
So is nicotine the concern? I mean, maybe. I think we need more studies to kind of see what kids are using and, you know, kind of replicate those results over different types of samples and over time. Mm-hmm. But in terms of youth initiation, I think the flavorants are a concern. Now, you'll hear the other side from folks is, you know, well, if there's flavors in these e-cigarette products, it could entice adults who are smoking tobacco cigarettes to transition to an e-cigarette, and maybe that will be like a harm reduction sort of strategy. I don't know those data as well, to be quite honest. What I do know is that the dual use of cigarettes and e-cigarettes is quite common among adults. It's, in fact, it's the most common poly tobacco use pattern in the United States among folks that use multiple tobacco products is dual use of cigarettes and e-cigarettes. And we know that you're probably not reducing health risks by using both products,
yeah.
Right? I mean, we don't know that for sure because we need longitudinal cohort studies, and this goes back to what I was saying earlier. So, you know, we don't know that definitively, but looking at exposure data, right, like looking at what people are exposed to from these substances, you know, it would suggest that if you're going to use an e-cigarette, it's probably better.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because with dual use, if tobacco is still in your life,
yeah.
It surely is still a health risk. And I guess, I don't know whether you mentioned this, because I might have immediately just forgotten, but you know when you said with the 3% of current users, is that just sole users of e-cigarettes, or does that include dual users that currently use?
So my understanding from that report is that it includes dual users.
Right, okay.
Yeah. You know, the reasons people pick up an e-cigarette are pretty... they're diverse, right? So people pick them up just as the substitution mechanism, like you had kind of alluded to, and then there are people that are like, you know, I really think that my cigarette use is harming my health, and I want to use this product to kind of transition or reduce my use of conventional tobacco products, and that could be what's happening with dual use. It could be just a simple substitution phenomenon. I think a lot of what we go back to in the e-cigarette realm is like, we need more studies
yeah.
with longitudinal designs
yeah.
to disentangle these sorts of questions and really get better answers.
Absolutely. I think everything just comes down to more research.
Right.
We just thought we need to know everything.
And at least it keeps us in a job.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And especially because what, e-cigarettes came out in 2004?
So my understanding is 2007 in the US market,
right.
So like mid-2000s. And, you know, that's not, from an epidemiologic surveillance perspective, that's not very long.
No.
So people always want to know, are e-cigarettes more harmful for you? You know, there's this perception that e-cigarettes are more harmful than conventional cigarettes. And again, the data from exposure assessments would indicate you're definitely not exposed to as many harmful byproducts as you would be to a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I forgot what my point was.
what did I think?
It's still early.
Yeah, no,
coffee.
That's what I was going to say. Because if it came out into the market in 2007,
right.
Not everyone would move into that straight away.
Correct.
It's still like a slow progression into being popular.
Correct.
People don't click their fingers and everyone's like, ah, e-cigarettes, I trust these, let's go buy them. It's word of mouth, it's advertising, it's marketing.
Yes.
So, you know, potentially it takes a few years for it to get on, which means that that's even less time for us to be like tracking and studying. So, you know, ideally from 2007, but that's only like, what, 10, 11 years? When in reality, we've got even less.
It's only 10, 11 years. And the other thing that makes e-cigarette research such like a sticky wicket, right,
mm-hmm.
is that over those 10, 11 years, the product spread that's
yeah.
out there it's totally changing,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, you've had these, they refer to, so they, I mean like the research community,
yeah.
they, you know, there's this designation of different types of devices. So e-cigarette devices, they have like the first generation devices. So these are like the ones that look like cigarettes, these little tiny sticks with, you know, the blue light at the
yeah.
end. And then you have like what's called second generation devices, which they call these pen style devices. So they're a little bit bigger. They have like, they might have a tank with some solution that you can see. And then you get into the third and later generation devices that these are those big, like big tank systems. Yeah. You can definitely see somebody holding these. So when you're tracking like our research here and, you know, research that's been conducted elsewhere, is that all of those different devices generate different levels of exposure to contaminants, and they all generate differing levels of nicotine to the user, and the user's behavior and the way they interact with the product also matters a great deal. You know, so the way that people puff on an e-cigarette, for instance, matters a lot with the way that the nicotine gets into their body.
Yeah.
If a user is... you know, let's say they have one of those big tank system deals, and, you know, they're changing the temperature, those types of things can influence the amount of toxicants that go into their body. So when we're looking to answer those questions, like our broad question, are e-cigarettes good or bad? I mean, there's so many moving parts. They haven't been around that long. They're a completely heterogeneous class of devices, so it's not like you can make a broad blanket statement. There was, I don't know if you saw the recent report by the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. So they just put out a very comprehensive review of the literature on the public health implications of e-cigarettes. And there were some good conclusions that came out of that. One thing that they did conclude is that it looks like exposures from e-cigarettes are far lower than combusted tobacco cigarettes. I mean, that evidence is pretty solid. What that means in terms of health risks down the line, not really sure. Yeah. Not as clear.
Yeah.
Totally different based on the user, too. Like, different users with different profiles, different levels of nicotine dependence. You know, it's just, it's really interesting. So, lots of questions, lots of studies needed to get better answers. Seems to be my sales pitch this morning.
Yes, I think that's it, isn't it? You just need more time. Okay, so, in our final few minutes, I want to ask you what you're doing with tobacco. Oh, no, you've already asked. I've covered it. I was going to ask what you're doing with tobacco and cannabis, but you said it right at the start.
Yeah, I mean, just working on trying to finish a dissertation.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. You know, we're working on some studies over here. You know, those are still very preliminary. Working with, you know, large survey data sets. So you and I will be working together on some kind of disentangling these modes of delivery among youth in three countries, so US, UK, and Canada.
In Canada.
And I think that'll be a really interesting and informative study, because, as you know, there's so much that we don't know.
Yeah.
The marijuana research literature is so behind the times, and there's, you know, considering that there's increasing marijuana, you know, liberalized marijuana policies taking place, like, in so many areas, we really need to get a better handle on health effects related to various modes of delivery. You know, what does that mean in terms of respiratory health? What does this mean in terms of psychosocial health-related outcomes? You know, cannabis. There was another report on cannabis, actually, National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, and there wasn't a whole lot of firm conclusions that came out of that report, mainly because the research literature is so limited. But one thing that was pretty clear is that, you know, if you have an increased risk of or propensity to, like, psychoses, right? Using cannabis can exacerbate that. It can, like, really lead to some psychosocial harm. So, you know, those are things that we need to consider when we're looking at the tobacco marijuana interplay as well. And then we ask these questions, like, you know, with modes of delivery, what's harm reduction? Well, what's harm reduction for respiratory illness might not be harm reduction in the other way.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think many layers of complication. And then another layer of complication, you know, a lot of these concentrates, you put them in a vaporizer.
Yes.
So people think of, like, oh, this vaporizer, you know, this is safer. It's safer for my lungs, maybe, or, you know, whatever the users are thinking, because we need better studies to kind of figure all of that out. But then, you know, if they're vaping a product that's got, you know, 75% THC content, and they're doing this every day or several times a day, you know, that's might be something to be concerned about. I mean, it sort of might not be respiratory health at that point, or maybe it's less of a concern, let's say. It's interesting stuff.
It is interesting stuff. And to be honest, a perfect time to end. Just saying that it's very interesting and there's more work to be done. And I look forward to working with you in the future.
I do as well.
Yeah. So thank you for joining me.
I don't think I will ever perfect ending an interview, so I hope you enjoyed the show and catch us in 2 weeks.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.